Pretty weak. Good morning. Little better. Little better. Thank you card today from Lisa Douglas, David Reynolds, and Glenn Reynolds from the family of Miss Janice Reynolds, who passed away. And we, I think, gave to the food pantry as a class as a result of that. And it's just a thank you to you guys for that. Before we pray this morning, remember this is life group night, and so tonight at 6 o'clock, we are going to look for you at Chinatown. The meal is free, and you're paying for it through your class offerings, but we will cover the meal out of class offerings, and we would encourage all of you. One of the reasons why we've turned a night or two out in May and June, of course, there's three holidays out of the seven, so they just interrupted any program that you'd try to do, Father's Day, Mother's Day, and Memorial Day. But tonight is life group night, and one of the only places in town large enough for most of our class that has a private room is Chinatown. So I have called Wong out there, who comes to church here at times, and he's reserving that back room for us. But I need to get a general count of how many to expect tonight. So let me see if I can do that sitting down. If you, in this section, if you're coming tonight, would you raise your hand, please? Okay, in this section. All the rest. What was the question? Okay. All right. Okay, so that's about 50 of us. We will expect you tonight. If you didn't raise your hand this morning, decide you can come, not a problem. I will tell him between 50 and 60, but come on and be there just a little bit before 6. We will have prayer at 6, start through the line to eat, and in fellowship as long as you guys want to. Many of you have asked me about Maggie this morning, so I want to make that a prayer request. Her heart is certainly back in regular beat. She had AFib. Her heart rate went very, very high. We went through the emergency room. They've got her on two meds, and unfortunately, it's lowered her blood pressure and her heart rate to the place where she's just very weak. They wanted to do that to keep it down, make sure she didn't have another episode. She'll go back to the cardiologist on Thursday, and he will tweak the medicine and maybe get it bumped up, plus the fact it just takes a few days for the body to get used to that medicine. So when those two things have happened, I think she'll be as good as new. And it just that she's on a med now she was not on to protect her from having another episode. So remember her in prayer, if you will. Now, if you have a prayer request, lift your hand, please. Okay. Thanks so much. Jerry McRae, would you lead our prayer this morning? Amen. Okay, we are in the book of Acts, and today is lesson 21 that covers the last verse of chapter 22 and all of chapter 23. It's probably necessary for me to kind of give you a little backdrop, set the stage. In chapter 21 and verse 27, Paul is arrested in the temple. The reason for that arrest is that the Jews have become suspect of him, and they are highly upset that it is possible that perhaps he has taken a Gentile into the temple area. And as a result of that, the Jews are stirred to a maximum anger, and there is conflict within the Jewish nation concerning the Apostle Paul. In Acts chapter 22, verse 1, Paul addresses the people, and he does so, if you remember, in the Hebrew tongue. And you say, why is that important? Because he has already proven himself to be a Roman to the Romans, and now to show that he was raised among the Jews and is an Orthodox and strict Jew, he speaks in the Hebrew tongue, not in the Aramaic of the day. And speaking in the Hebrew tongue would have let them know of his upbringing, his background, and his teaching. What does he say in the Hebrew tongue? Well, the whole of chapter 22 is a recounting of Acts chapter 9, which is what happened to Paul on the road to Damascus when he was saved. And he tells them again about hearing a voice and seeing a bright light and being told to go into the city. And in the city, Ananias comes to him and lays his hands on him. He receives his sight. And then later he is baptized, and he calls on the name of the Lord and is baptized. And then he goes to Arabia, we're not told here, and spends some time there. And then he comes back and his ministry begins. And that was further back in the book of Acts that took place. But in chapter 22, he just recounts his testimony. In chapter 22, about verse 22, the tribune saves him from the insult and the assault of the Jewish people, and they carry him away and decide that he's really done nothing against the law and certainly nothing worthy of death. So they hold him. And that brings us to today's lesson, which is lesson 21, and we'll be able to cover this, I think, rather quickly. There are three confrontations that Paul faces. One of them is with the Lord, and you might think that the word confrontation is not a good one, but it really is, because God confronts Paul, saying to him, Paul, you need to have some courage in this matter and some confidence in this matter, because I am with you. And if I am with you, you should not be discouraged, because you will not only testify of me in Jerusalem, but in Rome. And we'll get to that in a few moments. Chapter 22 and verse 30 through chapter 23 and verse 10. But on the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priest and all the council to meet, and he brought Paul down and set him before them. So who is this that has done this? It is the head of the tribune, where he has said, I am a Roman citizen. And so the head of the tribune says, I really want to know what you're being accused of. You've broken no Roman law. You're not worthy of death as far as the Romans are concerned. What is the gripe of the Jewish nation? What's the complaint? What are they accusing you of? So 23:1, looking intently at the council, Paul said, brothers, I've lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. And the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. And Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, order me to be struck? Those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, when Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other Pharisees, he cried out in the council, brothers, I'm a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees, and it is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. For the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply, We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down and take him away from among them by force and bring him into the barracks. So Paul and the Jewish council, that is the conflict and confrontation that we're speaking of here. The Roman captain had two serious problems. What are the official charges against Paul, and what would he share with his superiors? Because he's standing as a middleman who's going to send Paul further on down the line to Governor Felix, and then finally on to Rome for Caesar to inquire about Paul. And if you're the sergeant, you want to make sure that you give right information to the lieutenant. And if you're the lieutenant, then the general is somebody you don't lie to, or you don't not do your homework in front of. So here's where the tribune is. Though he is the head of this region, he is certainly not the governor of the province, and he is certainly not the ruler from Rome. So he's got these two issues. What are the official charges that the Jews are laying against Paul, and what will he tell his superiors? Oh, this is just a Jewish uprising. He's broken no law. He doesn't deserve to die. Turn him loose. Is that what he's going to say to his superiors? Or is he going to say, one life is better than a revolt of all the Jewish people that are in Israel? But Paul takes care of the problem. How does he do that? He divides the crowd. Will Rogers used to say that the definition of success was to never let your enemies have lunch together. Now, what he meant was keep your enemies apart. Well, Paul has enemies of the scribes, the Sadducees, and the Pharisees. And what's the best way to divide that group? Find an uncommon denominator, not a common one, but an uncommon one. And what is the uncommon denominator? What's the biggest theological issue between Pharisees and Sadducees? The resurrection. So Paul says, hey, I am a Pharisee. Boy, that got their attention. And I've been called into question because of the resurrection of Christ from the dead and the resurrection of all true believers. Well, the Pharisees said, he's not such a bad guy after all. And the Sadducees said, double blasphemy. Not only what he was doing, what he's saying right now. And so he divided the crowd. But in dividing the crowd, he picked up some support. Now, there's a couple of interesting things here. One of them is the original confrontation between the high priest, Annas, and Paul, when Paul said, I've lived before God in good conscience up until this day, and it angers the high priest. You haven't lived in good conscience before God. Smite him on the mouth. And then Paul says, about the high priest, not yet knowing that Annas was the high priest, he says about him, God is going to smite you on the mouth. Are you sitting in judgment according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you're asking me to be struck? You're nothing more than a whitewashed wall. Does anybody really understand what the purpose of whitewashing is? To cover up the stain, the taint, the decay, the dirt below. It's not painting. Whitewashing is just a means by which you cover something up. If you were truly a professional painter, you'd remove the problem before you painted the product. But whitewashing is just the dumping of a colored water, white, on something without trying to sand it or remove the problem to cover up the problem. Well, that's not very much of a compliment. In fact, that is pretty much of a criticism. You're nothing more than a whitewashed wall. You have decay and dirt underneath this robe that you wear. No wonder, he said, I didn't recognize you as the high priest. What you say and how you act have not been credentials of a high priest. Now, the best illustration that I possibly could give you is if you were to hear me spout off a number of curse words and I was outside of these walls and then somebody said, you know, he's the pastor at Central Baptist Church. Do you know that? Well, he sure doesn't talk like one. He doesn't act like one. That's exactly what Paul is saying. How could I have recognized you as the high priest by the way you have talked, with me saying that I have lived before God with a good conscience, and you saying, smite him or strike him, which was not how the Jews went about business. Well, then Paul perceives that there are Sadducees and Pharisees there. And he divides in a masterful way, he divides the crowd by saying, I am called into question on the doctrine of the resurrection. Paul begins his defense with this personal approach. I'm a Jew. My conscience is clear. I meant to, I jotted this down, so I'm going to kind of backtrack just a little bit. When he says his conscience is clear, it's an interesting word, clear, there. You don't find that but four or five times in the Bible. And in this sense, clear means like cleaning a window so that the sunlight might come through. Or maybe we're all old enough, at least a few of us are, to remember the old coil lamps. Occasionally, you'd have to take the globe off and clean it because it would get real smutty inside. And as a result of that, the light that was inside just wouldn't do much. And so it was amazing when you took it off and you cleaned it real good and you put it back on and it was a clear glass, how much more light you could get out of it. When Paul says, I have a clear conscience, he's saying that the Spirit of God has cleaned me so that the light of Christ can shine through. So all of us ought to be able to say, I have a clear conscience before God. And then, so he starts with this personal approach, saying he's a Jew, his conscience is clear. And then he ends with this doctrinal approach, saying, I've been called into a question on the resurrection of the dead. And the Pharisees take his side, and the Sadducees are opposed to him, and the tribune, afraid that the groups are going to be at war with one another and that Paul is literally going to be torn apart as a result of that, they take him away from them by force and bring him back to the jail, to the barracks. That's not the only reason that Paul had been called into conflict, but sensing that he could divide the crowd, that was the singular reason that he exposed or he exploited before them. So you've got Paul and the Jewish council. Then you've got Paul and the Lord, just one verse, verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. So I gave you a little three-point outline, the Lord's message to Paul. It started with courage, be of good cheer. My translation says take courage. And then it had a commendation, you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem. And then it said you can have confidence, you are going to testify also in Rome. And as I've reminded you about Peter in a couple of messages ago, when Peter said it was time for him to lay off his earthly tabernacle and his life on earth was about to end, and he's in his 75s to 80s at that point. And I took you back to the book of Acts, the 12th chapter, when he was put in prison, and right after the Passover, right after Easter, he was going to be put to death, and he got a good night's sleep between the guards. You remember that? And I told you that when you're 30 years old and they change you between the guards and they have intentions of killing you the next day, if God has already promised you that when you are old, certain things are going to happen, you need not worry about dying the next day. Remember me telling you that? So now, here Paul is recognizing, I'm not going to die in Jerusalem. I am going to make it to Rome. Now, let me tell you where that's really going to play a significant amount of importance in Paul's life. We're going to get about two or three chapters from here, and there's going to be a terrible shipwreck. And the storm is going to come through, and they're going to have to cast everything off the ship that they possibly can. And all the soldiers are bemoaning the fate of that ship. We're all going to sink. We're all going to die. The storm's going to get us. And Paul calls all of them around and says, guys, I have heard from God. If I make it to Rome, so will you. Not one life will be lost. It is important for you and important for me to remember what God has said. Because if we remember what God has said, it often changes how we feel about what's happening. Let me say that again. It is really important for us to remember what God has said. Because if we do recount the promises of God, it often changes how we feel in certain sets of circumstances. Paul, you could die in Jerusalem. Paul, you're going to testify of me in Rome. So what does that mean? Jerusalem is not going to be his deathbed. He's going to make it to Rome. What does that mean when the ship starts taking on water? He's not going to die in the sea. He's going to make it to Rome. And that principle proves itself comforting to all of us who really do trust in the Lord. Whether it's okay today or not, it's going to be okay. Whatever the doctor says, we know he does not have the last word. Whatever the results of the blood work is, we know that God is still in control. Whatever happens in the world that's around us, we need to handle it with wisdom. And I'll make reference back to Paul dividing his enemies. Sometimes wisdom really does help the circumstances. Fear does not, anger does not, conflict and confrontation does not, but wisdom can help the circumstances. But regardless of the circumstances, Christ is Christ, and if you recount all of his promises that he never leaves nor he never forsakes, then something of this nature will not cause you to give up and throw in the towel. Be of good cheer, that's courage. You have witnessed in Jerusalem. He was commended. You will witness in Rome. Have confidence. that what I say will take place. That's the Paul and the Lord. And then Paul and the Jewish conspirators. Verse 12 in chapter 23. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. That's not all that unusual. That kind of vow between men happens several times in the Old Testament. It's a vow to fast until the accomplished mission takes place. And this is the accomplished mission. We're going to make sure we shut the mouth of Paul once and for all. So there are about 40 of these men. Now that's not good odds unless God is on your side, and then suddenly your odds have changed. That's 40 men who take a vow to covenant together to fast or not drink until they've killed Paul. More than 40 who made this conspiracy. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We've strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we've killed Paul. Now, therefore you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you as though you were going to determine his case more exactly. And when we are ready to kill him before he comes near." So here's the simple plan. One of the Pharisees, maybe the high priest, contacts the Roman tribune and says, "You know, we may have been a little hasty here. Bring Paul back to us and let us talk this thing over with him, and we may be able to solve the problem right here on the local front. He may not have to go to Rome. He may not have to appeal before Governor Felix and go to Rome." And so that sounded good to the tribune. That saves him from having to talk to his superiors and say, "Well, things are out of hand in my quarters and I need your help." You know, it sounds good to him. So he's going to do that. Well, the nephew of Paul, the son of Paul's sister, heard of the ambush, and he goes to the barracks and he tells Paul what's going to happen. So Paul immediately says to the soldiers, "Get this man to the head of the tribune. Tell the head of the tribune that you've been lied to, that they're not wanting me to be brought back down so that they can interrogate me and probably ease up on the charges. This is a ruse to get me out of the barracks and away from the Roman soldiers and back into the presence of all of the Jews so that these 40-plus men who have vowed to kill me can do so." So when the tribune hears about that, he understands how much danger there is both to his position, if this gets out of control, and to Paul, because the ambush would certainly have meant the Roman soldiers would have moved in and word would have come to the governor. Man, they've got a real mess going on down there in the tribune's area. So what he does is he brings Paul in and he tells the young man, first of all, "Tell nobody that you've informed me of these things." And then he calls, and listen to the protective group that he gathers together. He says, "Get ready 200 soldiers." So 41's not too many now. 200 soldiers and 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen. So it's about 470 to 40 plus at this point. He's protecting Paul. And he said, "I want you to take him to Caesarea at the third hour of the night, once it's gotten dark, and provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor." And then he wrote a letter to Felix. "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency the Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen." And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. And I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. Have you ever heard of passing the buck? Well, you have just seen where it originated. The head of the tribune says, you know, if this is not going to get solved, then it's going to get shoved off on somebody else. So he said, Felix, because I trust you and because you're the governor and because you're a man of integrity and dignity and all of those kind of things, I'm sending this man to you and I'm telling the accusers to come and make their case before you because you're so much smarter than I am and I would not be able to come to a great conclusion here, but I so respect you and I so know that you will. That's exactly what the intent here is, to pass off to the governor the decision about the Apostle Paul. So he's taken to Caesarea. Now, any of you that have been to Israel remember Caesarea. And you remember that's where Paul has been imprisoned. And Caesarea is the home of Herod's summer palace. Herod is the tetrarch of Galilee. And so in Caesarea, where Felix the governor is also, he's going to be safe. And one of the reasons he's going to be safe, and one of the reasons the Romans did what they did, when the sea is on one side of you, you only have to defend the other side. And so foot soldiers and horse soldiers and chariots are not going to come at you from the sea. And they had no submarines back in those days, so ships are easily spotted a mile plus off. So nobody's going to surprise attack you from the sea. And so it only leaves you one side to be guarded, and the leaders, Felix and Herod and all the leaders, the kings and whatever, they were safer in Caesarea. That's protection. Now, provision there. Well, there was always a cool breeze off the ocean. And Israel is almost unilaterally the same temperatures year-round as Conway. They don't quite get as cold at times, but it sure can get hot in Israel, especially from Jerusalem downward. Up in the Tiberias area, not so much, but from Jerusalem downward, it can easily get 95 to 100 degrees. And down on Masada, it can get 110 to 115 degrees in July and August. That's why you don't take trips to Israel if you intend on going below Jerusalem in the summertime. Most of the trips start back in the fall and they end sometime in the spring, about this time, and not much further. All of that having been said, they're coming down to Caesarea. So the warning that Paul gets from the nephew puts him back under the orders of the tribune, who take him and send him down to Caesarea. When he arrives at Caesarea, let's just pick up with verse 30. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipas. And on the next day, they returned to their barracks, letting the horsemen go on further. And they come to Caesarea, and they delivered the letter to the governor and presented Paul before him. And on reading the letter, he asked what province he was from. And when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive. And after he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's praetorium, or Herod's palace, campground is a good word. Probably the best word is, if you remember the old westerns and the forts that had guard posts, and you were free to move about inside the fort, but because of all the Indians, you didn't go outside the fort. Okay. Well, that praetorium gives you that kind of idea that Paul was not chained or guarded and put in a cell. He was free to move about in certain places in the praetorium, but he couldn't get outside of that. And he's waiting on the Jews to come up from Jerusalem and lay charges against him. And in chapter 24 that we'll do next week, it'll be 5 days later. And it takes them 5 days to get from Jerusalem to Caesarea, get their act together and get to Caesarea where they're going to lay charges against him. I'll just say a couple of things about today's lesson and then maybe give you three or four or 5 minutes to visit with one another before we go. One of the things that I think is very important for us to remember is while we've really been keying in on the Apostle Paul, and not saying much about the overall spread of the gospel, I do want you to remember that in all of those places where Paul, on his second missionary journey and on his third missionary journey, in all of those places where he established churches, those churches are prospering and they're growing. One of the big complaints that Rome is having is hearing from all of the outlying provinces that the Christian community is becoming stronger and stronger. Much like the Pharaoh who feared that the Israelites would turn from being slaves and take over Egypt, and that's why he wanted to make sure that he followed after them and that they drowned in the Red Sea. That's what the Roman leadership is concerned about. This move of the Christian church is growing by leaps and bounds. They hear that in Ephesus and Philippi and Smyrna and Thyatira and Laodicea and in all of those locales, these churches are blossoming and blooming. Corinthians and Ephesus are churches that are making a difference in their city. They get complaints from people who say, now that folks are turning from idols to the Lord, our living had been adversely affected. We were making those idols right and left. We were turning 10 idols a day out and selling 11. It was a hot commodity and a great business. But now that many people are turning to Christ, they're no longer buying idols. So the Roman hierarchy were hearing complaints about Christianity changing things. And then they were awfully worried about Christianity because what they saw was an ever-expanding group of people in all of these provinces and in all of these villages where Paul had gone preaching the gospel. So now you come back to the Apostle Paul. It's not that he's just a renegade Jew who's preaching everywhere he goes. It's that he's left behind him a string of converts who are doing exactly what he did, and this thing has really multiplied. He's no longer being looked at as a singular individual. He's now being looked at as the author of all this gospel that's being spread out all over the known world of that day. And they have no doubt heard that he wants to make it to Rome to preach the gospel there too. So the Jews are very stirred up that they are being adversely affected in Judaism, and the Romans are very stirred up that this new Christian growth is going to outnumber them at some point and cause problems in the Roman community. So Paul is caught between that old proverbial rock and a hard place, knowing full well that he's still doing the will of God and still preaching the Word of God. So there's some real practical lessons for us, and I hope you're not just listening to me each week like it's a historical lecture. Well, that's what happened then. I hope you can grasp enough of this to walk out these doors on Sunday at noon and say to yourself, you know, if God's made a promise, it's going to come to pass. And no matter who stands against us, if God's for us, who can be against us? And maybe you'll come to the place where you say, I may be the only one in my office or in my neighborhood, or maybe even, God help us, but maybe even in your family. I may be the only one who really stands up and says, God can and God does and God will, and I believe in God. And maybe you feel a lot like Paul, pushed and pulled and torn between what certain people think and what certain circumstances are. But the principle that we learn is we need to be of good cheer. We need to have courage because the God who has brought us thus far will take us home. He'll take us all the way. He who hath begun a good work in us will complete that work until the day of judgment. Principles, I think, that comes out of the last few weeks that we've had. Well, I'm going to let you go 5 minutes early and just fellowship up a storm for 5 minutes and have a good time and welcome those who are coming in for second service. And remember, tonight at 6 o'clock, we're going to meet together. And I hope more of you will change your mind and try your very best to get there. We'll be there from about 6 until 7, but if you can, arrive about 5 till 6 so we can have prayer at 6 and begin to eat. And remember, it's at Chinatown, third exit. Am I pointing in the right direction? Here in Conway. Yeah. By Penny's, by J.C. Penney's. That's where Chinatown is. Okay, thanks so much for being in class this morning.